Ashton Vassar Kane is a graduate student in the Human Rights Program. He's been working on the Mansfield Training School Memorial and Museum Project since 2023 and is the Assistant Director of Archival Preservation at the Pennhurst Preservation and Memorial Alliance. Through his work, he advocates for disability justice initiatives and aims to uplift those impacted by medicalization and institutionalization. Our second panelist, Nadia Scott, is a history doctoral student at the University of Connecticut. Her research focuses on how visual culture impacts identity formation, nation building, and ideas of citizenship in 19th century Latin America. Prior to joining the Yukon community, Nadia has worked as an independent curator and writer. She graduated from Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, with a BA in history and a minor in curatorial studies. And Kathy Hanowitz is the director of the Southbury Training School in Southbury, Connecticut. She received her master's in social work from SUNY Albany and will bring the disciplinary perspective of social work to our discussion. All right. So what I would like the panelists to do, I'll invite you to do, and I guess we didn't really establish an order, is to just in the context of this documentary and the larger context of Mansfield Training School and this field in general, we asked you to sort of bring some comments, about 5 minutes or so, and we'll go through those, and then we'll have an open discussion.
Yeah, so I think that the main thing that I kind of approach this work with is that Mansfield Training School is not a unique case. There's disability institutions all over the country. And they've like all had different lasting impacts on the community in the area, and just nationally. It was part of like a larger eugenics campaign in American history. And we really saw a push for deinstitutionalization around the 80s and 90s. And obviously Mansfield Training School closed during that time after years of litigation. And I think that from a human rights perspective, the field of human rights kind of still doesn't always acknowledge disability and the role of disability and medicalization as used to restrict access to rights. As you can see with like people being institutionalized upwards of 40 years, and that's not uncommon with places like this. So I think that in my work, both with the Mansfield Training School Memorial Museum Project and the Pennhurst Preservation Memorial Alliance, we really try to like kind of dig deeper on the history and the historical context, and then also we see glimpses of these like personal stories. And of course, that's rare, especially like the Mansfield Training School is still on the Yukon property. Yukon still owns this land. It's been closed for over 30 years, and there's no memorial. There's no nothing that has been done with the land. And so we lose a lot of the personal narratives because they're all kind of medicalized and redacted in the archives because of the situation that, because of them being institutionalized, their lives have been medicalized, and then that is now, medical information is now redacted. So seeing something like Fred's story in his own words is something that I very much value because not everybody got the chance to have their story told.
Yeah, thank you.
To jump off what you were saying about the importance of own voices, that's kind of like the first thing that really like struck me, like having no background in this type of work at all. I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say? But what you were saying, like the importance of own voices, and oftentimes we'll get documents from like admin or nurses or other like official people that give this really official master dominant narrative of how a situation played out, but documentaries like this are important because they counter that. I think of it as someone who's done a lot of work with museum education, and always think about how can we challenge our audience and what they already know. So if someone already comes in with the presumption of what institutions like this looked like, we show them something like this that's pushing them to think a little bit more critically about the situation and the historical context and how far we still have to go. Also, when I was looking at this, I think it really made me think a lot about how even when we get really great documents pieces of like these really personal stories in the archives, we still have to read them critically. Like, just because this is Fred telling his own story, we can't take it as, oh yes, this is everything true that happened 125%, because we're still getting his story mediated through the producers, through how it was edited. So always thinking about what is and isn't shown, what questions did they ask and didn't they ask, how are things cut together, who are we introduced to in this space. And I think the documentary shows a little bit about kind of like those leading questions they would ask them. Well, how did you feel about this? How did you feel about that? And we can see the narrative they are trying to construct. And I'm not saying that to be like, oh, they're bad trying to construct narrative. No, that's just how, that's what humans do. So always trying to evaluate bias when we're thinking about when we come across sources like this. And I think this documentary in specific is really interesting because it's kind of an exercise on truth claims, because you see Fred's story juxtaposed with like this newscast. And so like if I had like, I don't know, a group of probably high school students, and I would be like, okay, what are the two different perspectives that are being presented here? Which do you believe more and why? Because the same way that the documentary was cut together and made very specific choices, the newscast was. So thinking about how different people may put together, have the same like set of facts and present it in a different way. What else did I want in my really scrambled notes? Yeah, I said something about media literacy. That's all good, source evaluation. And I think also, yeah, the newscast is just as valuable a source as the documentary. And we don't want to say, oh, one source is better than another. They just tell different stories. So I think that's always important when we're doing stuff like that. And also to not take Fred and his story as representative of every experience everyone ever had in these types of institutions. He represents one perspective that a lot of people may have also experienced, but we, when we're dealing with marginalized groups, I think it's really important to not just take someone and say, okay, this was the experience everyone else had. We can't make one person the voice for an entire population. And also, it's a really great example of how language and what is acceptable changes over time. Yes.
Perfect.
You guys got it all covered. So,
thank you.
So, first, I guess I just really want to thank all of you for the opportunity to kind of be here and enter into this, you know, conversation from a whole bunch of varieties of perspectives and input. And the other person that's really important to thank, and I don't know where Fred is in the world at this point, but to thank him for having the courage to do his story, and actually the people that engaged with him, because oftentimes that hasn't been our experience. So I guess what I would like to do is just be able to, you know, bring some more information to the conversation, hear questions, hear what your perspectives are. There are still 106 people who live at Southbury Training School. I'm hoping that, you know, as a people that have recognized how important history is, how important all of the different disciplines are that come together in the lived experiences of people, that we are gaining a better understanding about how we empower each individual to live their best life and the life they want. So that's kind of what I hope to hear from you.
Very good. Thank you so much. So, questions for one of our panelists, all of our panelists. We have Ashton, Nadia, and Kathy. It looks like we've got a question here.
Yeah, I'm just going to go swinging right away with a really big concept question. And so, with this whole talk about the Mansfield Training School and how it's currently under your ownership by UConn, it all kind of screams to me a degree of irony, because Mansfield Training School is in itself an institution that was associated with multiple other institutions. And yet here we are 30 years after its closure with no real vision of it, under the guise of it being owned by another institution, being UConn itself. That has to make me really ask, was UConn's involvement in purchasing the land, was that more of a business decision in terms of saving face on their involvement with the facility? Or is it just the fact that they really didn't know what they really did want to do something with it, but they never figured out the vision of what to do after the fact?
So there were proposals for what could have been done with the land that have been kind of floated by several times. I think that that's kind of a concern that I carry with me in this work every day as a UConn student, as somebody affiliated with the institution that is not removed from the harm. Going back to like 40s and 50s, we see the UConn's connection and the UConn Foundation's connection with establishing the Mansfield Training School Board and the joint board with Southbury. So it's very important that we kind of like understand that positionality going into work like this, because it's something I try to be very conscious of, that like, and unfortunately Fred did pass away in 2005. I'll be visiting his grave as part of an independent project I'm doing where I'm cleaning the graves of some of the residents all throughout the state. But a lot of people never got the chance to kind of speak out about this. And then again, with UConn still owning the land and UConn working so closely with Mansfield Training School, I mean, they would have volunteer programs, as we mentioned in your class, where they would take a resident home for the holidays and stuff. Like, UConn is not, it's not a coincidence that UConn owns the land now. So, yeah.
I would also raise the point that in order to really publicly access this kind of documentary today, you would need to go into a UConn archive site in order to do it with UConn authorization as well. So it kind of feels less like we're trying to have the right to be able to view these things, and more so we need to be directly involved with institutionalization ourselves in order to have a chance to even break it down. And at that point, what's the point in having these conversations if at the end of the day we're still tied down to the institutions as the basis of all our actions? Like I said, kind of letting swing.
No, I really appreciate that, and I agree, because I've taken a lot of inspiration from other states, because I work with other states' institutionalization memorial projects, and I also run another smaller group of like institutional survivors who are always asking this question about like what we would want done, and unfortunately, like, the reason that it's so slow going now is because we need to make sure that as people who have connections to UConn, we're taking care with these stories. I'm not going to assume what anybody wants to be done. Like you said, there's no one way that somebody experienced institutionalization. This is a nationwide effort, and a lot of people were impacted by this.
Right, but it does seem like there's a lot of overlap in terms of how these incidents are reported and what exactly these people are reporting they experienced. So let's just keep that in mind as well.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yeah.
Sorry. I know that this is like a way to Connecticut Juvenile Training School. There's kind of been like debate about whether or not it should open, and if it does reopen in what capacity would it kind of be used in? Do you think it's important to kind of, I guess, just worth using training schools that have had concerning like history, whether it was through past abuses against children, like in the case of CPS. Do you think they should be reutilized in that form? Do you think they should just be completely like not a training school, like not used at all, I guess?
I think I got part of the question, but I didn't hear it all, so.
Maybe it's a little bit about whether the reuse of the land or the facilities.
Yeah. And like in what capacity, if they should be reopened as training schools again, even if they've had histories where they're kind of concerning.
Okay. So maybe it has to do with sort of the evolution of our thinking about training schools. Like, you know, will these facilities be reopened with some new manifestation of the idea of a training school, or should they be utilized in some other way? And I don't know, maybe Kathy, maybe since you're involved in a training school now,
and a lot of years of history. So I guess I really would hope that, you know, we have taken all of the things that we're talking about, but the history of people in general. I think there's so many things that go into how we as a society have value humans and value integration and value the different cultural things. Personally speaking, I think you raised the issue, but I think our initiatives in DEI and diversity and equity and inclusion and just the thoughts behind what society told moms, dads, families, children, how services and supports for individuals have changed over time. And I think with that becomes the evolution of our thinking about how is it that we empower each other? Who is it that we value? How do we bring those values, those cultures, those integrations? You know, oftentimes in my very early careers, which, you know, when I left social work school, I was this young thing that, you know, and I was the youngest thing that at the trade school, and I was the social worker, and I was getting everybody out. I had never seen some of the things that, you know, I learned about quickly. But I think that with that, I had to take, in order to really, I think, empower the disenfranchised and to give value to anyone and everyone, that we have to bring those pieces, and we have to hear the voice. We have to hear the ugliness of people's experience, but we also, you know, when I learned the history of Southbury, what I learned was that it was created with the thought of it being, you know, a college institution for those that were most challenged. And how it was designed and how it was set up and how it was thought to be an all-inclusive, integrated community where the people that lived there and their families lived on campus, everybody did things together, the community came in, people went out. It was a different lived experience. There are still many, many people that I have supported over the years that have struggled with any part of that institutionalization. But I think in order to learn from it and move forward, we must acknowledge that it happened. You know, that whatever that history is, whatever that value is. You know, it's kind of strange how I got here today. I'm not really sure how that happened, but as you know, these things unfold, I'm thinking... Ashton mentioned that, you know, he does a lot of projects in terms of doing the gravestones and acknowledgement and that kind of thing. Tomorrow at Southbury, you know, we're having our, usually we do it around the second week of September, but tomorrow will be our annual Remembrance Day, where there aren't people buried at Southbury Training School, there never have been, but that is a history of institutions. It's a history of forgotten people. There was a time when I was like, you know, the local funeral home was like, what are you going to do with the people on the shelf? What do you mean there's people on the shelf? You know? So I think that acknowledging that's a part of people's history and people that we in society have disenfranchised. And ultimately, what does that do to us as a population?
I also wanted to mention, going back to the question of like reusing the land, they did attempt to, so in the late 80s, they built a prison on the Mansfield Training School property. That's obviously now closed again. At this point, something like Mansfield could not really be repurposed in that way that you mentioned, the juvenile center as well, probably more recently, because there's so much contamination and asbestos and just kind of like neglect over the last few decades that a site like Mansfield Training School wouldn't be able to be repurposed in that way. But in terms of like other centers of like state institutionalization, I think that it's like important, like you said, to learn from the mistakes of the past and to have a proper acknowledgement of what happened.
If I could just because I live that experience right now, is that it's. It's really important to have this multidisciplinary understanding, and you know, I think, yeah, okay, my background's social work, and I've been a clinician for a long time, and I engage with people, and I'm like, you know, how do you do that? But the other pieces, you know, when Southbury was built, it was because Mansfield was exploding, and the state didn't know, you know, moms and dads were told to give us your babies, and the theory behind, you know, medical care and psychology and everything else was, give us your babies, we'll take care of them for life. You can come on visiting Sunday and it's all good. You know, that was the professionals of the world, the trained, educated people. There were no, you know, and it was family. It was grassroots families, individuals saying, I'm not going to give away my baby, you know. But you know, Southbury was built as with the WPA. You know, if there's people that are interested in the Southbury is on the National Historical Register. You know, and there's like architectural stuff that people. That'd be great if we could. However, there's probably been so many studies the state of Connecticut has done, and engaged with the town and taught. What do we do with the property? It's probably some of the most gorgeous property in the state of Connecticut. You know, I said I really am blessed because the sun rises over the mountain and the lake every morning, and it goes down every, you know, and I watch it come up and I watch it go down. But then it becomes. Are we going to spend money to, you know, do something to preserve the buildings, to preserve things? It's probably been 10, 15 years, but there were all kinds of proposals. There was task groups, you know, and everything from part of the property, Southbury, is at this point actually is under the Department of Agriculture. It's not even under DDS. And that actually, you know, is similar to Mansfield, as you described, in terms of all the different ideologies things go through. The problem is that we all own that as taxpayers in the state of Connecticut. So I'll be quiet because I could ramble. So sorry.
Quick question.
I have two questions, and I guess they're kind of connected. I'm going to start back with the story, with Fred's story, and how we can think about that as a memorialization itself, right? But I'm more about the North because I love these kind of narratives. It's a work that I do, but what you feel we learn from Fred, not just about Mansfield Train School, but about him also and his experience, because for me, occupies several different aspects. So that's the question for the film. And then it connects out to, and it's especially something for Nadia, but Kathy and Ashton too, what kinds of things might happen memorial or museum. But first, let's talk about Fred.
To go off of talking about Fred, and I'm really glad that you asked, because this is something that really stuck out to me when I was watching Fred's story, is he's always trying to like introduce people. And that juxtaposed with like his story about how he felt like nobody was listening to him, and he said that he felt isolated and that he kind of had to go somewhere with the supervision of an employee. So now that he's out in the community, I'm really kind of, even from like the very brief interactions about this is how I know so-and-so, really stuck to me, because like if for 40 years you don't have that kind of ability to interact with your community, and it really like stood out to me at how he narrates his daily experiences to the camera. And it's like, this is the clock, and it's 8 a.m. on Thursday morning. And that might not be something that I would find particularly notable, but like this, to me, it reads like he's on TV, it's important to him, and then this is his life. And this is something that like we might not think twice about. But again, spending 40 years in an institution, those connections become really important.
Ooh.
And for the second
question. What would this look like for a memorial project? That's a good question. I think I'm often hesitant when I'm doing stuff to just put a documentary in a room. Because, you know, like if you go to the museum and they have like, you know, you have the gallery space and you see like, you know, someone's boot and then like a stack of text about why that boot's important, and then off tucked away is a room like this and it's super dark and you have the documentary going, and then depending on when you walk in, you've missed half of it, or you're coming in at the end and you don't really get the whole story. So I'm often hesitant to do stuff like this, but I like stuff like this when you kind of clip it up and sync it to, I hate blocks of text on the wall. There's nothing that drives me up a wall on the wall more than so. I think if we, I don't know how much like material culture is still preserved from spaces like this, but I can envision a space where you have, let's see, I don't even know, what's the object that would be common?
Yeah. So with Mansfield, mm-hmm. A lot did not make it out of the buildings. Again, there's no dead. This memorial museum project is a web-based memorial museum. There's no physical space where we have this. So museums like that, like, yeah, the museum is important, and yeah, it could be boring and take for granted like the artifacts that we get.
But what when there's nothing, when there's no space dedicated to remembrance, that's where we kind of are at odds with how to move forward with this. So the summer I spent the entire summer in Pennsylvania establishing a community archive and special collections with the self-advocates who came out of the Pennhurst State School and Hospital. And that was a very different perspective because a lot more came out of Pennhurst. A lot more people got into the community and were talking to each other, had their stories told. They started organizing local chapters for called Speaking for Ourselves. And then this is part of the larger People First initiative. We don't have a lot of that out of Mansfield. So looking towards memorialization, it's like, I feel like a lot of people in the archival and curation spaces sometimes kind of take that space for granted, but we're fighting to even get the space in the first place.
Oh, wow. I didn't see digital as a whole different ballgame, but I think digital, especially moving forward, you know, I think digital exhibitions, curation, all really, it became like the it thing during like the heat of COVID when no one could go to the museum. So thinking about how can we bring people into a space where they may not be able to get to for a slew of reasons. They are physically unable, financially, all these, so thinking about how the museum can be more inclusive by happening in the digital space. And now you're talking about when you lack the materials. I don't know, I think that's, I don't know. I think I'm even imagining, like, I don't know if that would even be appropriate, you guys can correct me on that, of like, what it would be like taking these kind of own voices of you as a person, you click into this digital space and it's your first day at Mansfield Training Center, what you're going through. I don't know if that's would be something that you guys would think would be helpful, but I that's kind of what I hear when I read more own voices like that, that more first person experience that users can go through.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of people like Fred who documented their stories, and we're starting to try to like compile community stories from like people who worked there, and family members have reached out to us. But it's not that we lack the material, because a lot of it has been preserved in like the Connecticut State Archive. We don't have the space, but we also don't have the luxury of having these stories accessible because they're medicalized. These are people's like lives, and they obviously, when you're institutionalized, your story becomes your medical information. And then that, like going back to the human rights aspect, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the amendment, like where it's like, where slavery is officially ended except as punishment for a crime. So the 13th Amendment, it's also if you're disabled. So if the state can find a way to insinuate that you are not capable, we see these human rights questions kind of come into place. And that's kind of the angle that I'm interested in. It's like, is there an excuse here for the state to restrict your access to rights? And obviously that's not the intention of people who work at facilities, and that's not the intention of like when they design a facility that it's going to be carried out this way. But because of the inherent power imbalance, I think it's kind of hard to separate like the person from the medical record sometimes.
That is the point about the medical history reminds me of a lot of reading I've been doing about like the archive of decolonialization. And there's a really great article by a really great scholar whose name is escaping me real bad right now. But she talks about how, you know, after imperialism and all of that, there was this really big rush for the archives and deciding were the archives gonna stay in the colonized country or were they gonna go back to like England and France and all of that. And then all these different laws came out, and she was talking about with her research, because she's looking at the welfare state and how we can trace decolonization through the welfare state in England, how more times when she was denied access to certain materials, it wasn't because in the UK they have like a provision in their free access laws, is like if it will endanger our relations with another country, or if it's someone's personal, if they didn't ever expect when they went into these offices that then their personal life story was going to be put in a book somewhere. So she often, that was more times than not while she was being denied access to certain archives. And that kind of puts us in a weird kind of ethical place where we as researchers want to tell the stories of these people, but I think you have to have that check on yourself of would they want their stories told in the way that we're doing them.
Exactly. And that's kind of why something like a first person like walkthrough of a digital site would probably be something that I would lean away from that because also there's no way to experience the institution.
Mm-hmm.
The institution that was here on the property before Mansfield Training School was called the Connecticut Colony for Epileptics. And that institution, so there's been institutions on this site for since 1908 to 1993. And there's no one story of the institution. There's many different like administration changes that we see like going through the decades in the archives. Like each superintendent had a new wave of policies. So there's no one story of the institution. Some people were there for a few years, some people were there for decades, some people went there as children, some people died there. There's no one way to tell the story. And yeah, sorry, I know that you've had a
team.
No, that's great. And I just want to start by saying I really appreciate the project.
Thank you.
The effort to memorialize I've been living here for 10 years, and it's been very hard to know what it is.
Yeah.
And I would just add that from my perspective as a resident in town, and also as a faculty member here, the history is ongoing. It closed in 93. But while we have those buildings there in a state of disrepair and decay, the stories that are being created around those buildings are yet another wave of history. And it tells, and when I did try to do research on what those buildings were, what I found online was that this was a site for students, urban archaeology. And there were photographs of abandoned wheelchairs and hallways. This is creating yet another narrative of a haunted space that's writing a kind of story about these institutions, right? And I will share with you a story. So I was teaching a course, and we were talking at one point about the history of psychiatry. And it was shortly after Halloween, a student came to me, and she confessed that she and her friends had broken into some of the buildings, because that's what they do on Halloween around here, apparently. And the student gave me a very fat file. It was a psychiatric file of one of the residents, because that wasn't even secured in these buildings.
Yes.
I said, I thought you might be interested. And I looked, Mansfield resident, people who still lived in this area. And there was no avenue for me to report this. They just wanted to know who broke into the building, which was not really the point. Right, all of this is online, and these files are accessible to students who want to break in on Halloween.
Yes.
And this is a whole other chapter of neglect.
I completely 100% agree with that, and that's been something that has been very troubling to me, because when I started trying to talk to people about, hey, there should really be a history like analysis of this, we should really start to get to know these community stories, everybody's like, oh, I heard Depot campus is haunted. It's like, let's unpack that. Why is it such an unsettling place to be? Let's think about the history. And so it's upsetting kind of juxtaposing like the work that I do with the archives at Pennhurst versus the work that I do here with the archives at Mansfield Training School, because there's been such prolonged neglect. I don't believe that that's unintentional. Like, they've had so long to make any sort of acknowledgement. So I know that you could probably speak to this as well, being deeply unsettled by the history, but being not able to quite like place that within like grounded in like people and the humanity of all of this. It's like people carried out these policies, people were interned here, and we are left having to understand it with the limited resources to do so. And it's very personal and a very human connection that is missing.
I have a question. What right now is, how are you guys envisioning this memorial digital space?
So the next step for us is we want to establish an advisory board with people that either have family members, maybe residents themselves if they want to, and people who worked there to consult on the next steps of this project. It's not our position to make those kinds of decisions without input from the community that's been impacted, especially after so long of just
the property being neglected. So we want to make sure that like we're covering all our bases, and we're not like making like, this is not a pet project to me. This is not about my research or like furthering my academic career. Like it's, we really want to ground it in, this is people. So did you want to say anything about the people centered approach?
Yeah, I gave you my lecture on being person centered. But you know, I think that would give direction. You know, if there's anything I can offer, I mean, I don't know how much like you've reached out with self advocate, like you talked about that as being a very large group. I mean, self advocacy in Connecticut is pretty awesome and pretty powerful. So there's a lot of people. You know, the people who lived at Mansfield are becoming fewer and fewer, just given age and what happens. But there are still some folks. So.
No, I was going to say, I we may chat sidebar about this, but as I'm kind of thinking through it, the lack of materials you guys have from Mansfield, and I'm sure this would be a whole to do. And what you're trying to do with this community outreach is trying to talk to families when you start getting those personal archives. And you're talking about, you know, people being come to you and being like, oh, just give us your babies. What if there's newsletters and stuff that families may have held on to, I think would be really important for that more digital space. And
yeah, we have a lot of that, like, from the Connecticut State Archives. Mm-hmm. It's not that we have, like, no material. It's just that, like, compared to other institutions, like... And when we do have the material, it's in the state archives, or it's in personal archives, or it's kind of scattered around. And it's not even super important that it stays here. It's just that there's no central place. There's no central, like,
which is ironic, because the state has the actual facility, right?
To, and,
you know,
and the surplus
deteriorated as it is, the space is there.
Yep.
But the struggle to value it in a certain way is, I don't know, practically insurmountable. So there's a comment about useful taxpaying citizens, right, in the piece produced by the Board of Health in the 60s. And, I mean, institutions are come in many forms, and the largest is sort of the institutionalization of what human value is, right? And so it's budgets, it's money, it's facilities, and I don't know if there have been conversations about, can we convert actual space into museum space? And I would imagine that would be a difficult obstacle to surmount, right?
Thank you.
I've been at universities, I've only been at UConn 8 years, I've been at universities 32 years, but I think that part of the struggle to value it really goes back to the fact that UConn will then also have to step forward with its own complicity in the whole thing. So it's better kept and not even opening the record. That has seemed, and I'm coming from Connecticut from that side, and that's how I'm reading it. Because when I travel all around all over the states, there are these sites, memorialization. But there's not one here. And I think that there's really something behind that.
And this is part of the continuing narrative, right, that Zoe's talking about. So you have a question?
Actually, another thing I would like to point out in this whole talk about the sheer lack of transparency, the sheer neglect that comes with this entire situation, another thing I really want to bring up that's really starting to get under my skin the more I hear about this whole thing is just, I don't even know what it was like being inside the building. Like, I have so little foundational understanding of what exactly the architectural space was like, and what the rooms were like, what the bedrooms were like, what even sleeping in that facility was like. I can't physically or visualize it in any capacity, and it's really getting under my skin, because that in itself is a major part of why this situation matters so much to the people here.
Yeah.
The fact that I, as someone who has lived through these sort of experiences similarly, am still having a very difficult time picturing it, is a massive red flag to me.
Well, we haven't put pictures of like all the dormitories and like pictures of the residents at all on the website, and that's an intentional choice right now as we move forward with it, because there's some pictures of the architecture there, but a lot of the stuff that is still at the Connecticut State Archives, like I feel some sort of like ethical protection for, like, I'm not gonna put the worst of the worst just kind of out there for anybody who wants to go get it. And I'm also not gonna like try to insert my own like narrative as an archivist That's something that we just don't do. But like while we're in the process of taking over those next steps, that's something that will come up into conversation a lot because those pictures exist. And it's kind of a catch-22 when you want them to be seen, but you also don't want them to be used irresponsibly.
But then that begs the question, why aren't we allowed to have more of these kind of conversations more openly?
Yeah.
Why does it have to be in this built room specifically at this specific time in this specific year? Why did it have these conversations have to even be considered at this point in the history of our lives?
And unfortunately, nobody like was really trying to pursue those questions earlier. So we're kind of left to pick up all of this neglect, and it's just really unfortunate. I know that you've had your hand up for a while, so I wanted to make sure I got to you.
I grew up around here, and I actually met Fred. I went to Eastern, and I took a class, and I was a special ed, I was doing special ed at the time, and an employee at Mansfield Training School would bring some of the residents to Eastern, and I was assigned to Fred. He was Freddie the Can Man. And just watching that, I mean, I work here at UConn, and every day I come to work, I drive by there, and it's just a crime that there's not some memorialization. You saw Fred, he was just like us. And the stories need to be told, and thank you for everything that you're doing. Thank you for all of this. But like someone else said, we should all know what it was, who these people were. They, you know, but yeah, their privacy. So it is tough, but people should know the general stories. And I would love to volunteer if you take any volunteers. I know some former employees that I don't know if they would be interested in or not, but just thank you very much for doing this, and any help I can give, I'd love to.
I think we'll definitely be following up with you, because, and I really wanted to thank you for sharing your personal connection to Fred. I feel a lot of similar emotions, like watching his story, and as we continue to involve more of the community, like we're working on kind of like an oral history project next with this, and Brenda, you'll probably be hearing from Brenda and I on that, but thank you so much.
I could just share one story of a man I knew very well, who lived at Southbury, who actually lived at Mansfield before he lived at Southbury. And he left Mansfield and actually came to Southbury to build Southbury. So he was one of the very first people that ever showed up at Southbury. And he actually literally worked right alongside everybody, and he, to the day he passed, was the mayor of the world. And he was able to travel and do his things, and you know, he had his things he wanted to, but the folks that I've met over the years that had time at Mansfield are amazing people, just like everybody has their story. But yeah, that his name was Ed, he's a fabulous man. And, you know, the other thing, just recently I had some folks come into the office and ask, because, you know, part of that, I still learn new things every day, but of the history, even with Southbury people, is that there was a whole, in the early, in the 30s, when Southbury was being built, actually there was a group of people who were individuals that were receiving services, but they also were helping to build the facility. And then when the Korean War happened, a whole group of them went off to fight for our country and to fight for us and to, you know. And they're like, you know all those things that some of the towns are doing where, you know, they, if you are from wherever, you know, Mansfield, and they're putting up pictures of servicemen and honoring people. These folks came in actually because they knew that story, and they're like, can you please, you know, is there any pictures? Are there any, these people need to be honored. They fought for us, they died for us. It's just, there is so much of the story and the history of people that has to be captured.
Yeah, I just always wondered if Freddie had not been institutionalized, if he had had a proper education and interaction with everybody else in the community, you know,
And unfortunately, this was the advice that was coming from the experts.
Yeah.
This is like what families are being told to do. This is the professional advice. Mm-hmm. And we can look at that here and be like, well, that makes no sense to me. And how could this happen? And it just, it's really upsetting that Fred's story isn't unique like that.
I think the role of humor is really interesting in that documentary also, and how he's hilarious.
Yes.
And how you can sort of process that as you're also taking in the larger picture of what story is being told. It's a pretty profound gift, I think, that he brings that humor into the movie.
We were reached out to by a man who knew Fred, who said that he would tell stories all the time, and he wrote down Fred's stories, and he's going to send them to us.
Oh, wow.
So we're, stood out to me as well.
Now that gives me a whole other idea in this virtual space for the people whose stories we do know more about, that kind of, you can click, here's Fred, click, and then you get all these, you get the documentary, but you also get really great histories like yours and these letters that can, even though we may not be able to reconstruct everyone, you can get a good enough snapshot of what some people were going through. And the people's whose lives they impacted also. I think another important thing is like agency, and things just didn't happen to them, but they happened to the world as well, and showing that.
We are nearing the end of our time. We do have the room till 6:30, but understand if folks need to go. But we, you know, if there's another question, or have a few more minutes. Was there a question? Or?
Well, I actually have a question for you, because you captioned the film. And I actually know that Hannah, said hi. And Hannah tried to caption it. She and Emma couldn't be here. Can you say something about that experience? Because, you know, it's way past the history and the time of the film, and, like, there's so many names and things in it. And
I did caption the film. I had never captioned anything before, so I had to learn how to use... I used it in Kaltura. It was kind of fascinating to go through it. I noticed plenty of things I'm going to want to touch up and correct, and watching it, every time I watch it, I notice something. But I don't know, I think it was, there's a lot of just timing slides is another part of it. But there were little spots where I had to write indistinguishable, and there were some moments where I had to just go by what I was hearing. Some of the names, right, Licky, and it would be interesting to actually confirm.
Bozy.
Yeah, right. Bozar, right? Yeah, right, right, yeah.
But that's very real.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like that, then, that you made it, try it, because that's really real.
Yeah.
That's how all of us hear or don't hear the things that you missed.
Yeah.
But I know, Hannah, you guys really struggled with the use of the word retarded, you know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it appears so many times, and it's just not a word to use today, and so they were in quandary about that for quite some time.
There's a bound copy of a psychological study at the UConn Library stacks. There's another one I interlibrary loaned, and I'm forgetting the psychologist's name. Maybe you recall he did a bunch of studies.
Yes.
Zeman, right. And I did reach out to, like, there is a Zeman award that's offered here. But, and those are, again, those are written, published, I suppose, artifacts that also should be, I assume those are, you found some of that stuff in the archive as well? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a copy.
And then there's social work study from the 60s on integrating people back into the community, which Mansfield was pretty early in that conversation compared to like some of the other state institutions, which was kind of shocking considering like the neglect that we're talking about after the fact.
Right.
But I think that also kind of speaks to like which version of the history we get and from what source.
Yeah.
So just quickly, I don't really know much about disabilities. I'm still learning. So I don't know if this thing actually exists, but I had an idea that would help in this regard, that there should be, we have health inspectors, there should be something called accessibility inspectors. We'll go down to these different places, whether it be hospitals, libraries, and check to see if places are accessible for everybody. Doesn't matter if they're labeled as disabled or not. I mean, I could use it. I'm a short person. I can't use the top shelf on the library.
Never can. Vertically challenged.
And there's not a step stool in sight. And then I have to go to the librarian, and I feel bad because she's like the age of my grandmother. I don't want her doing that. So there should be more accessibility things, and there should be people who have knowledge on this, or either state-funded or funded by the town. So is there something like that exists?
So the ADA, and technically there's ADA compliance, but the ADA compliance doesn't necessarily mean accessible. Mm-hmm. So for example, the ramp at the back of the library has been busted the entire 5 years I've been here, and there's a family of mice that lives in there. Now, it's still a ramp that I can get down, but if I were somebody who was self-propelling a wheelchair, that would be different. And so technically, because it exists, doesn't mean that it's the best version it could be, and that's kind of like all these other institutions. Like, yeah, Mansfield existed, it was the best that they had at the time. But was it actually working for people? That's like an entirely different question. It's interesting because I feel like, especially like as an activist instead of like an academic, I think that a lot of momentum in disability advocacy and activism has kind of dwindled because not everybody knows our history and how we got the rights that we have and how we need to keep fighting to make sure that we keep them. So that is something that I kind of is always at the forefront of my mind, because I think people, like especially like in our generation, the post ADA generation, kind of take that for granted, mm-hmm. because they don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a ramble.
All right, I want to thank our panelists so much. Kathy, thank you.